This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, maybe it's Florence, Arizona, like the man we'll hear from today, wherever you live, there are heroes around you. And you might never imagine some of the stories they can tell, stories from when they put their lives on the line for us. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we're educated, we're entertained, even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This week, we'll mark the 70th anniversary of one of World War II's greatest tragedy. It'll be the subject of a major motion picture coming out next year on Memorial Day. Nicolas Cage will star. The working title is USS Indianapolis, Men of Courage. But you don't have to wait until next year to learn the story from a man who experienced it firsthand. And actually, it's the opposite. We don't need to jump ahead. We need to go back in time to an interview I had the privilege of conducting with Adolfo Celaya. We're revisiting that conversation today in light of the 70th anniversary of a day that changed his life and ended hundreds of others. Hometown Heroes was only on one radio station back then, so I'm going to guess that most of you on all the stations listening today haven't had the chance to hear Mr. Celaya's story. At the time of the interview, he was living in San Jose, California, and was still working at the age of 83. He's 88 now and has returned to his native Florence, Arizona. His ship, the heavy cruiser Indianapolis, is often on his mind and will be even more so this week. July 30th marks the 70th anniversary of the Indianapolis being sunk by a Japanese submarine in the middle of the night. Survivors like Mr. Celaya were not spotted in the water until 3.5 days later, a catastrophic delay that cost hundreds of sailors their lives. About 300 died in the torpedo attacks and the sinking, but more than 500 more perished in the water later, whether from exposure, salt poisoning, thirst, or a relentless horde of sharks. We'll hear how Mr. Celaya experienced some of those moments, but we'll start with the unique nickname that adorns the cover of a book written about his life. I have a link to that book at hometownheroesradio.com. The title is Harpo, War Survivor, Basketball Wizard.
How long have they been calling you Harpo, Harpo?
Well, I guess it was since I was about 10 years old. There was a movie theater in our little hometown. That's about the only thing we had in our little hometown. And they were showing a movie of the Marx Brothers. I let it grow for about 6-7 months, something like that. And I got close to the picture of Harpo Marx, and one of the fellows that was there standing by said, "It doesn't look like Harpo Marx's hair right there. The only his is blonde, and this one is black." So they named me Harpo, and it stayed with me the rest of my life. In fact, up to now, most of the people in the little hometown of Florence, they don't know me by my first name. They only know me as Harpo.
And boy, do they know you. You're a legend in those parts, and for good reason, probably as much for what you would eventually do on the basketball court. But you would have never had a chance to do any of that on the basketball court if you hadn't survived one of the most famous tragedies, really, in American military history, the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. Let's start before that, because you're a pretty young man. In fact, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in December of 41, you're only 14 years old. So what were you, finishing
That's
up junior high?
Or? 13, 14 years old.
What do you remember about that day? Do you remember December 7th, 1941?
I remember it, and like I said, it wasn't that big for me at the time. I mean, because I just knew that the Japanese had attacked at Pearl Harbor, but my dad had moved to Tucson from the little town of Florence because during the war years they had air bases and stuff being down in Tucson. So my dad moved down there to get a job there during that time. So I was about 14 at the time when I left Florence.
Did you start thinking at that point that you might be joining the fight at some point, that you might end up in uniform?
Never. There was never it never entered my mind at all. I never thought much about it at all, and I joined mostly because a friend of mine wanted to join, and that was the reason I went in. My dad at first would not sign for me to go in because at that time, if you were 17, you had to have your parents sign for you. And my dad and my mother had separated in about 1938, 39, something like that. So my dad was the one that had to sign for me.
And how'd you talk him into it?
Well, it wasn't very hard. It was a little hard because he didn't want me to go in the first place. He thought I was too young for it and stuff. And I guess I was. I didn't think about it at the time. But the Navy uniform kind of got to me a little bit, too. I saw some of the veterans come back in with their Navy uniforms, and I kind of liked the Navy uniform. So I went to San Diego to my boot camp training down there.
Well, I'm sure if they would have told you that in the next year you're going to be on a ship that gets torpedoed and sinks and then you're going to have to avoid being eaten by sharks to survive, you probably wouldn't have signed up for the Navy.
I wouldn't have signed up at all. I mean, if I'd have seen the ship when they put me aboard, if I'd have gone aboard during the day and I seen that big ship coming from a little town of Florence, I would have probably still be running because it was a big ship.
Well, and I imagine growing up in Florence, Arizona, in the desert, doesn't prepare you a lot for being a seafarer. Did it take you a while to get your sea legs once you went out to sea?
I was almost 60 most of the time. I mean, it never got onto me, but it was quite a shocking to me to be on a big ship like that, especially at 17. At 17, it was a new adventure for me. I was really, but most of my, everything that I did during the war, it came as a 17-year-old. I was in the war at 17. I was discharged at 18, so.
Well, yeah, I don't, you know, of all the veterans I've interviewed, and we're talking hundreds, I can't remember a guy who came back from the war and finished high school. But you were young enough to do that.
Well, I had never gone to high school at all. I mean, I in those days, even if you had just finished the eighth grade, they would accept you. I mean, you could come in there.
Absolutely.
So I was kind of lucky to have gotten back afterwards after spending about 3 months in the hospital and stuff like that. I got lucky to go back to Arizona, and one of the coaches that was there, I gave him a lot of credit that I was still alive, was because he came around and asked me to come down to high school to play ball.
Well, I look forward to talking to you more about that, but we've got a lot that happened in between you joining the Navy and in between you playing basketball. It occurs to me, Harpo, though, that if you had the hair to earn you the nickname Harpo and you still had it when you joined the Navy, Uncle Sam certainly made you cut it a little bit. Did you still have the curly hair when you signed up?
Yeah, but they took care of it right away. They give you a crew cut haircut, and that you never saw that curly hair all the time I was in the Navy until 6-7 months afterwards. But they took it off.
That's a good way to ruin a good nickname, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, they took the hair out right away.
And how long was it from the time you signed up till you actually shipped out on the USS Indianapolis?
I would say that there was a big camp in around the San Francisco area called Shoemaker.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where they would send everybody to different places from this place, Shoemaker. And I was lucky to get aboard. They assigned me to the USS Indianapolis. I got to where I enjoyed the crew chiefs that I was in. I was a fireman, so I was down below most of the time. And so I was with a bunch of boys that treated me real, real good at that time.
I'm sure you were heading overseas just hoping to survive. I mean, you had to know you were going into some pretty wild situations, didn't you?
Well, no, I didn't think of that much. But when we did get to the first task force that they put into, that they went down to bomb Japan, which was all, around January of 1945. That's when I started realizing what I saw the big carriers and battle wagons and everything going in towards Tokyo when they went down and bombarded Tokyo and stuff like that. So that's when it started kind of hitting me a little bit of that I was involved in a little bit of a war.
Well, and that was, you know, that's often overlooked because of the battles that would follow, but that was the first time that American carriers had attacked Tokyo and mainland Japan since the famous Doolittle Raid, so that was a significant moment. You were there for that, and not long after that, you were there at Iwo Jima. Now, normally, you're a fireman in the boiler room. You're making sure that the ship has power, that those fires are burning. But when that bell goes off, when it's general quarters, you had to go topside, right? What was your duty station?
My duty was on one of the hatchets that was on there. If we were to get hit, nobody would open that hatchet. They'd hand me a 45, and I'd have a gun with me. But you know, at 17, I didn't know how to use a gun. I never fired a gun. So, but they did give me one, too. And that was my patrol was the guard that hatch that was there. Nobody was to come in or out from it.
And I know you spent some time around the big 8-inch guns that would be firing away at that fortified island of Iwo Jima. And I understand you have a pretty specific memory and a bit of an ironic and humorous memory about when the flag was raised atop Mount Suribachi. How did you hear that this was going to happen?
Well, I had a friend of mine at Santos Peña that we stayed together for many years. He passed away, but when we were in when I first went in, he kind of took me over in his wing. He was about 19 years old, and I was only 17, so he was kind of my mentor, and we kind of looked out after him a little bit. So. But his watch was up on top deck, and he had these big binoculars that he had to use up on top deck to look at everything for planes or whatever. But the day they were going to raise the flag on the mountain, he came running to me and said, they're going to raise the flag. And things like that was no news to me. So he said, we're going to raise the flag and a big deal and all this stuff. And he said, now they're raising it. So he handed me the big binoculars so I could look at them. And so I looked a little bit at it, and they were starting to raise the flag and all that. And I don't know why I did it, but I turned around and gave him back the binoculars, and I told him, I said, big deal, and walked away. After it became so famous and everything, whenever I went down to visit my friend Santos Bay in Tucson, right away he turned around and said, here comes the big deal, man. Because I didn't know it was going to become that famous. It was something else.
Well, nobody did, not even Joe Rosenthal, the man who took that photo, certainly not the people that were in that photo. But, yeah, maybe the most famous image of American military history, no big deal to you. So I guess you've gotten plenty of chuckles about that over the years every time you see a movie or read a book or see that shot.
Yep. Yes, it was.
That's pretty funny, and obviously what happened on Iwo Jima was no laughing matter, and as a 17-year-old young man, you also had to witness some pretty serious carnage. Was that a helpless feeling for you to be on top of that ship and watch the Marines being mowed down by those dug-in Japanese?
Well, at first it was, when I saw them going down, they had the landing barges coming from the other ships. We were out about 5 miles, I guess, from the island, maybe, I couldn't tell. But you could see the landing barges from each one of the troop carriers that they had them on there, and they were on their way down there. And being that that our ship was the flagship, everything that was happening would be put into the loudspeaker. And when they started getting hit, everybody thought that the Marines were going in there, and really nothing was supposed to be in their way. And then all of a sudden, all you could hear was Baker here, Baker there, and they were, they just tore them apart. I mean, it was just a terrible thing.
Nearly 7,000 Americans died in that 5-week-long battle for Iwo Jima. That image of the Marines raising the flag atop Mount Suribachi is captured in 3D bronze at the Marine Corps Memorial in Washington, D.C. For many, it's the most striking military monument to visit in person. If you were to visit Indianapolis, Indiana, you'd find a moving memorial to its namesake ship, the one Harpo Celaya was on 7 decades ago. And this weekend in Indianapolis, 14 of the 32 remaining survivors of that heavy cruiser will gather for a reunion. They'll be joined by family members of shipmates who are no longer with us. They'll discuss the ship's role in hastening the end of World War II. They'll talk about the horror of nearly 4 days floating in shark-infested waters. And those are some of the things we'll cover with Harpo Celaya when we come back. Go to hometownheroesradio.com for links to more information on the Indianapolis and the way her crew is being honored 70 years later. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.